Olá, Margarida.
Olá.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well, and you?
I'm good. It's very nice to have you here. So, today my guest is Margarida Carvalho. She's assistant professor in the Department of Computer Science NOR at the University of Montreal, and she also holds the FRQ Ivado Research Chair in Data Science for Combinatorial Game Theory. Margarida is an expert in mixed integer programming, algorithmic game theory, and computational complexity. She has papers in prestigious OR journals such as Operations Research, Management Science, and Mathematical Programming, as well as publications on the intersection of optimization, economics, and machine learning in top conferences like EC, NeurIPS, and AAAI. Margarida is associate editor in Informed Journal on Computing, OR Spectrum, and Dynamic Games and Applications. In 2018, she received the Euro Doctoral Dissertation Award for her outstanding PhD work. Margarida, I'm very happy to have you here. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, Margarida, I pronounce your name with my Brazilian accent from João Pessoa, Margarida Carvalho. I think it would be nice for the listeners to hear the pronunciation with your Portuguese accent.
It is Margarida Carvalho.
Yeah, it sounds a bit different than my pronunciation, but I think it's a nice thing for the listeners to be aware of. So Margarida, you were born in 1988 and you were the youngest subject to guest so far. How does it feel?
Oh, thrilling that you find that I was sufficiently interesting to be part of your podcast.
Yeah, and absolutely. And many colleagues of ours recommended your name. So for me, it was very easy to decide on that. So where are you from in Portugal?
I am from the second biggest city, Porto, maybe popular because of its wine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Vinho do Porto, as we say here, and there
exactly.
Probably. So there, I mean, in Portugal. Yeah, yeah. And tell me about your parents.
My parents. So my father is from Porto. My mother, she was from a small town in the north of Portugal, close to Braga. And she moved quite young to Porto to work, and then they met. And my mother, she works at the hospital. She has worked there all her life. And my father worked in an electricity company. Mm-hmm. Now they are enjoying retirement.
Very nice. Do they have a university degree?
No. None of them has a university degree.
Right. So are you an only child?
No, I have my sister. She's older, 4 years and a half. She has a university degree. She's a web designer. Mm. And a very special one because she's an activist of free software. So she does design using free software. So I'm very proud of that. And she also passed a bit that spirit to me.
Does she live in Portugal?
Yes. My sister is also in Porto. So my close friends, they are mostly in Porto. A few of them immigrated in the meantime. All my life since before I moved to Montreal has been in Porto.
Mm-hmm. How was life in Portugal 20, 30 years ago?
It was very nice. So I lived in the suburbs. And then every morning, the four of us will take the car and go to the city for school or to work. And so because I lived in the suburbs, it was quite safe to play outside. So I was all the time asking my parents, can I go outside? Sometimes they will get annoyed that I want to be outside all the time. And I had a lot of friends living in the neighborhood. So we pass our time playing football in the streets, they will play Barbies with me. We would read cards of operas. We did all kind of things that kids do.
Ah, so, very nice. Yeah, let's talk more about that. So you used to play soccer.
Yeah. So yeah, since I was very small, by some coincidence, we were all the time playing soccer, and at some point, so where I lived, it was a set of buildings, and they call it kind of a cooperative, and so that means that there was a spirit of putting people together, and one thing to do that was to put the kids together. So they had a football team, a futsal team, in fact, indoor soccer. And so, yeah, I was playing in that team until I was maybe 13. And then I played later in the university too. So in that team, I was the goalkeeper. And it was a moment of my life. Well, I think of women's life, where we have kind of an advantage because we go taller, faster. So many times when there was a corner kick, the coach would tell me, go to put the ball inside with your head. It was very nice that time that we were playing soccer. In the beginning, it was very bad. I remember our first match, we lost 16-0.
Wow.
So, yes, we were really small, and the other kids, we were maybe 7 years old, the other kids were maybe 12. That was very bad. But then, yeah, we started to get a little bit better. The same thing happened with the university. We were not an amazing team, but within a few years, our team started to be competitive and go to the finals and these kind of things.
Uh-huh. Did you change positions when you went to the university, or you stayed as a goalkeeper?
Yeah, I was tired of being goalkeeper. Also, it's easier to get hurt in your hands, and our hands are very important for coding, for writing. So I moved to be a right winger.
Ah.
Yeah.
So were there many girls playing at that time?
So in the team I played first when I was small, it was a mixed. Essentially, it was just boys. There was at some point another girl, but it was boys and me. And then, yeah, at the university, it was separated. It was a women's competition, so a full women's team.
Mm-hmm. You know that when we played indoor soccer in school, I was also the goalkeeper at times.
I think when I was small, because you use gloves and there is a special equipment, it's kind of cool. You want to try.
Mm-hmm.
But after that experience, I was tired. I didn't want to be a goalkeeper anymore.
Right. And which soccer team do you support?
I support Sporting. It is a team from Lisbon, which is usually kind of unexpected when I give that answer. Yeah, but it had given me good things in my life. So one of the main coaches we had when we were small, he was a Sporting supporter. So he had a bias to like me a lot. And he would put the Sporting music in his car when we were driving us to the competitions. The other thing was, I also like it to annoy like family by being from another team. So I thought by supporting Sporting, that will annoy my father, my uncle, but no, they will just be sympathize with me. So my strategy didn't work out.
Yeah, that was actually unexpected. I was expecting you to say Porto, right? Some team from your city, but not Sporting. Is supposed to be the rival, right?
But on the other hand, all the matches I saw, they were on Porto Stadium. So I'll go to Porto Stadium to see Porto Sporting, well, to see other matches from Porto. So I never went to the Sporting Stadium.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Francisco Saldanha da Gama, I interviewed him a couple of months ago. He grew up next to the Sporting Stadium in Lisbon. Yeah. Okay, so did you enjoy playing video games?
Yes. So sometimes it will rain, so I could not go to the street like I like it. So in that case, I'll play a lot of video games. I think by influence of my friends, we played a lot of FIFA, Pro Evolution, but also things like Need for Speed, Sonic, Mortal Kombat, Tekken. Guitar Hero. There was a point I was obsessed with Guitar Hero, and I was very good. And then my parents decided to give me an electric guitar finally. So.
So do you play guitar?
Very badly. I never had formal classes, but I play to for pleasure. So yeah, it's not amazing, but it's fine for me.
Sure, that's great. Were you a shy kid?
No, well, it's very particular because until my 12 years old, I was like quite popular and outgoing, and I don't know. I will not stress speaking in public. There are even recordings of me singing for an audience in school events. But something happened when I got when maybe I started the puberty, so around 12 years old, and I became very, very shy. I'm of course outgoing with my friends, but with people I don't know, I think I tend to be very shy. And that was especially remarked in classes to my parents that I'll not talk much during the classes.
Yeah, but with your friends, you were more relaxed and
Yeah, it's just a barrier. It's just that.
Is it true that you decided to become a mathematician at a very young age?
Well, I would say so. So it was not at 5 years old for sure, but when I was 12 years old, more or less, I decided and never changed my mind that I wanted to be a mathematician. I think somehow was because the things I liked it intellectually were very associated with being a man. So I was all the time when I was small being called tomboy. Well, there is a translation in Portuguese that, which I really didn't like it. I just like it to be a girl that happens to go to like soccer or to do puzzles or to do Lego. So, but all these things were associated with being a boy. So I think with math was like the intellectual challenge that no one will tell me it's not for you. You are a tomboy because of that. So I think that helped me to get into math, and I started to do all the exercises in the book. At some point, I was doing the exercises ahead of what the professor was teaching. Yeah, it started very early, that passion.
But did you take any vocational tests, or it came really clear to you that math was the way, or any other subject was also part of your spectrum of interest?
It was math, and then, of course, sometimes in physics and chemistry, there will be a bit of math. So I would like that part, but not as much as I like mathematics. But yes, it's common to do in Portugal around your 15, 14 years old vocational tests. And so I also did them. And it gave, of course, that I should go to sciences and arts. Of course, when you do them, you already are biased to answer the right question. So it's going to give the right feel. But yeah,
But arts.
it was a line. Yes. Yeah, I don't know if it was an influence of my sister because she used to paint drawings, sell them. So we used to go a lot to museums with my sister. In the beginning, I was very, very bored to spend a lot of time just looking to an image. But yeah, she kind of influenced me, and at some point, she was bringing home some comic books. From that were about this samurai rabbit, and I started to like it a lot, and that also influenced me to start drawing myself some comics. So yeah, I'll draw them. Sometimes I will even cut the characters and play with them. So yeah, there was this side, especially related to graphic novels and comic books, that I really liked. So maybe it was
Wow.
related with that.
Yeah, very
But
nice.
I draw badly, so it's good that I didn't follow that.
Yeah. It seems that you also like board games, as I can see in your background.
Yeah, yes, and I don't know why, but our community around usually also enjoys, so that's even more potentiated by having a lot of people interested to play with me.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I'm part of the club.
So when you come to Montreal, you will come here to play some game.
Yeah, I go to my friend's house, who's also a colleague, Bruno Brook. By the way, he did post-rock in Montreal, and he brought some games from there. He also played with some of your own colleagues around there. So yeah, sometimes I go to his house to play some games like Seven Wonders and other games. So it's nice. I know you did really well in math, but how did you perform in other subjects?
I was, until I became a teenager, okay student. So my parents, they were very good. I don't know how, but putting me the responsibility that I needed to do the homework. So I will never miss a homework. And if I miss the homework, which will be very rare, I'll feel very, very stressed. So I will do that. That was the bare minimum. So I was okay in most subjects. Well, a bit bad in Portuguese. I will do a lot of orthographic errors. Then, yeah, I became good at mathematics. And by consequence, I think that helped me to understand how to study chemistry and physics. Other material that, like history, I was very good memorizing, so I could memorize. I could also get very good grades. But the like English and Portuguese, I was just okay. So not really matching. Then in high school, I was able to push most of my grades to be very good. Still, Portuguese and English were my weaknesses.
Right. How did your parents react regarding your academic performance?
So my mother, and especially math, that was what would make me proud to get a very good grade. I will bring to her, oh, look, I got 100%. She'll be nice, good. My father will be all the time saying, oh, this is good, but you don't need to be so good. I'm happy if you get 70%. I want you to enjoy life, to do other things. And I'll get the two way, the two
reactions.
Sides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
Interesting.
So never a pressure to to perform very well.
Mm-hmm. Was there any reason for choosing the University of Porto for your undergraduate studies?
Yes. So the University of Porto, especially the math bachelor, was perceived as very, very good, of a very high quality, with a very good set of professors. So there were, of course, other bachelors in the country, but economically, well, if I'll stay in Porto, it'll be much easier. And the university was very good. The only possible drawback was that it was said that it was very hard to have a good GPA. So, for example, if you wanted maybe to become a teacher, that could be a strategical decision, because then you are scored based on that. But I didn't want you to be a teacher because I was very shy. So I thought, no, I don't want to live with the stress of having to talk to people in public all the time. So it was a natural decision to go to the University of Porto.
Mm-hmm. Except that you became one. You know.
Yes, yeah. It's very strange because the fact that I wanted, that now I really like to do research, and I wanted to do the research was not clear. When I started the Bachelor in Mathematics, I knew I wanted to do math, but I didn't know if I wanted to apply, if I wanted to do research. Research doesn't seem like something I would do, because I thought it was for genius. So it was unexpected to become a teacher. Even when I decided that, yeah, I wanted to do research, I didn't knew if I liked all the tasks that entails to be a professor. Now that I know what it entails, I really like it. And I'm very happy I ended up here. Like, working with students is one of the best things and makes me feel that life has a purpose. But that happened. It was not something I knew I would like to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you when you say that there's a sense of purpose when you work with students and make them grow and develop. It's just remarkable and amazing, right? Did you have coding classes?
Yes. So when I started my bachelor's in the first semester, we had a programming class to use Python. And I remember there was kind of a controversy because my colleagues would say, "Oh, we came to do math, not to code. Why is this part of the program?" I think it was very nice because they were thinking ahead of how important this skill would be. And after this semester, most of the other ones I had to code for example, numerical analysis. And I remember they had a course where we would code things that were useful for theoretical courses. So that was really nice. And then because each professor had their preferred programming language, I learned all kind of things.
In your experience during your undergrad?
No, zero. Zero contact with operation research. I didn't even knew the meaning.
Wow. And when did you learn about OR then?
So when I finished my bachelor, because now the bachelors in Portugal, they are typically 3 years, so it's common that you should do a master's, so I went to do a master's in mathematical engineering, and I was very free to choose which classes to do. So I chose to do still some classes in pure math, and then when I was searching for other ones to do, I had some colleagues that were ahead of me say, "Oh, we did this class in operational research in the Department of Computer Science. Was awesome. The professor is awesome. The problems are awesome. You are going to love it." Like, they sell it super well. And so I said, "Okay, let's try it." And it was one of the best classes I had because it matches. It contains so many different things: mathematics, but then applications, modeling. You really see science being applied. So, and there was a coding, there were some challenging projects. I really liked that class.
Yeah, so it was a revelation for you,
Yeah,
discovering OR.
yes, yeah. And it was there that, so the professor was Jean-Pierre Poudros, who became my master's supervisor and later PhD supervisor. So after I had it, he talked with me if I wanted to do the master's with him, and there was no doubt that I wanted. Yeah.
Very nice. What did you study in your master's dissertation?
So my master's dissertation was about the electricity market in between Portugal and Spain. So you have producers submitting bids of price and quantities of energy to sell, and then there is a system operator that decide which bids are accepted. So it's kind of a game theory problem. And the goal was to understand which are the most rational strategies for the energy producers, so which bids they should do in this market, such that they optimize their individual profit. And so I did a bit of Nash equilibrium computation. The method was very simple, was what is known in game theory as a best response dynamics. And that was it. There was a bit of a theoretical component too. But it was like an introduction to putting my hands on in game theory. I already had a course in game theory, but I did research on the topic, so that was very nice.
So that paved the way for what came next in your research career, I would say, right? So that was a good starting point.
It was very nice. So during the master's, I went to my first conference. I started to go to the seminar. So when you do research in Portugal associated with the master's or a PhD, you get the degree from a university, but you are always associated with a research center. So I was during that time until I came to Montreal associated with Inesctec. And there will be seminars in OR. So I also start to get a bit of the flavor of what it means to be in academia, to go to seminars, to network a bit. I did my first presentation in a conference. I also wrote my first paper. So it was a big experience.
That's excellent. I took part of that series of seminars organized there by the folks in Porto, online, of course. It's a very nice initiative. And you mentioned about your first conference. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so my first conference, well, was in Porto, so no travel, but it was Alioero 2011. So yeah, I made a 15 minutes presentation. I think maybe I had five people attending, but because there were other parallel sessions. It was the first time I saw Andrea Lodi, who later became my co-supervisor during the PhD. Yeah,
Were you
it was
nervous?
I don't have a I don't recall. I know other I have big memories of presentations I made where in the days before I could not sleep. For that one, I don't know if I was already getting a bit more used. I don't remember to be nervous, but I'm sure I was.
Yeah, were you able to publish a journal paper from that work?
Yes, we submitted that paper to a journal. It was rejected with some harsh comments, and then we went to submit to another journal. I think because the topic was maybe a bit novel by the time, especially in the intersection of OR and game theory. And if we go to papers to journals that maybe are more into an our audience, we might have a hard time getting these multidisciplinary kind of topics there. And of course, to be fair, it was a master's work, so also it had to be adjusted to the right journal.
Yeah, we'll get back to that later. But you mentioned that you got harsh comments. How did you react? That affected your motivation, or made you rethink of continuing in the field? Because I know that some young researchers might feel really upset when they get this negative response, especially when reviewers are really hard on their words.
So to be honest, with this master's work, I thought they were fair because I didn't feel like, oh, I discover something that was really a breakthrough. But with other works that I submitted and that I got also tough comments and that I was more proud and I thought they were good, then my reaction is always like, to write an email to all co-authors saying, I think we can say this, and this, and I can also show this. And it's usually I have, and maybe I think that's quite common. You know so well your work that you know how to clarify things and what can make things stronger. Of course, if a reviewer doesn't want to understand something, well, in that case, we just need to clarify, well, maybe you are not understanding, or ask an editor to intervene, and that will sometimes happen because if you know a lot about mixed integer programming, but not so much about game theory, it can be hard to get this to get what I'm doing there. So my reaction, yeah, is usually I know what I did, so I can. Sometimes I feel that the comment is fair, sometimes I don't think it is, and I find a strategy. And of course, sometimes, even if you have a strategy, you feel discouraged. And that's the moment where having co-authors is especially nice because you encourage, you see another perspective. So for example, one thing that happened during my PhDs, most of the times I will not be the corresponding author. It will be one of my co-authors. And that was nice because once we get the decision, the co-author that was a more experienced researcher will process the decision and already transfer me the email, but with something positive in case the decision was not so nice. I
Interesting.
think that's very important to do. I think it's a nice strategy when we work with a work that's led by a junior researcher.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I usually ask my students to be corresponding authors for them to learn, to get through the system. And I know they are inexperienced, but they have to learn by practice, and I understand your point, but I think I see from the other viewpoint is that make them learn. And of course, there could be some bias when the reviewers notice that, oh, it's the junior person, or they might not even have a clue that if it's a junior or not. But if it's not the famous author or the most known author submitting the paper, they might see it in a different way. I don't know, but I see exactly what you mean, and I think it's just different ways of.
Yes, definitely. Because, for example, now I don't have fun making the submissions. There are so many things, and then sometimes you have issues compiling like the bib tags, and it can waste a lot of time.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. What made you decide to pursue a PhD degree?
So, that's a very interesting question. So when I finished the master's, I wasn't sure what to do. So it was back in 2011, where Portugal was going through an economic crisis. So all my friends that were working in the industry, in companies, they were having a very bad time with low salaries, no life-work balance. So I was wondering if I also wanted that. And furthermore, my master supervisor, he had hinted me that we could try to do the PhD together. So at that time I thought, okay, I really like not to have a boss and decide my own schedule. And economical wise is a better solution. It's better to have a PhD scholarship. Of course they are competitive, but if you get them it's better than having working in the industry in a company in Portugal. So these two things combined helped me to decide. And I was also in the moment of figuring out, well, do we really need to be genius to be PhDs? Because my parents, they were not in the university. I had no one in academia around me. So I always thought, oh, being a full professor is really for people that are talented and genius gifted. And can solve gifted people. But this experience during my master's, it's not that I felt people were not smart. I just felt I can also maybe do it. And my PhD supervisor who had experience, of course, he was encouraging me. It was because it was a possibility. So yeah, we applied to these national PhD scholarships and I got it and I started the PhD in 2012.
Yeah. You're not the first person from Portugal to tell me that the decision to continue with the higher studies was motivated by financial reasons, which is unusual, right? When you think of, you know, improving your income, you don't think of following academic path. I mean, the sense of you don't think of pursuing a PhD degree for that purpose, right? It's interesting to know that.
I think in some sense, some governments that we had in Portugal, they were engaged on trying to promote science and giving very good education. And we have very people with very, very good PhDs from Portugal.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's fantastic. So let's talk about your PhD work, which was mainly focused on using mixed integer programming to solve game theory problems. I was thinking that you could describe your research activities year by year. So let's start with the first one.
Yes. So when I applied for these PhD scholarships, one of the things that attracted me to do the project that we had in that application was the fact of traveling and going to other places. So the goal of my first year, that was in 2012, was to go to Bologna and to work with very popular people that exist there in our to attend their classes and get more background. So I arrived there. Andrea Lodi, he was assigned to be my supervisor during that period. And I had heard that he was a superstar, so I read some of his works before meeting him. And so the first time we met, I told him, oh, I saw that you did some bi-level programming in this paper. This is just a Sackleberg competition, so something that belongs to the field of game theory that is connected with what I want to do. So maybe we could do something in bi-level programming. And so he gave me some references, in particular a PhD thesis from Scott Tenegre, where he had a branch and cut algorithm for mixed integer bi-level problems. In fact, integer bilevel problems. And so I found there a special problem that was the knapsack interdiction problem. And I thought, okay, instead of using this general purpose method, maybe we can do something very tailored and help us to understand more from the methodological point of view bilevel programming. And I proposed to do that. And yeah, we started to work on the topic. Then because of Andrea's experience with the other people in bilevel, he was like, I think this is one of these sigma 2p hard problems. And so we also had Gerard Weginger joining the team. And because, well, in Bologna, Andrea was sharing the office with other professors, including Alberto Caprara, well, he started to jump into our meetings. So that also helped me to understand the dynamics of collaborating in academia. It was a very rich year. And yeah, I worked in this bilevel interdiction problem computationally. So it was the first time I used Python with a solver. And I started with the brute force method. Then I went to see, oh, I think we have these valid inequalities and we improve it step by step. And then we also did some computational complexity related work related with that work. So that was the first year. And then it was one of the best years of my life.
Yes.
Research went very well. And Bologna is a very nice place. Yeah, with very good food.
I can see that you seem really excited when you talk about that period. I'm also glad that you were able to meet Alberto Caprara before he passed away, right? So it should have been a great experience too. And how was the corridor experience in Bologna?
It was life-changing because until that point, I never liked to study in group, work in group, go to cafes to work. It really, I needed silence and being alone. I would say to everyone in my bedroom to leave because I always would need to be 100% focused. So working in a corridor, that's impossible. And in particular, I had a printer in my bag. And so people were coming all the time to get printed stuff with noise. So it was life changing in the sense that I learned how to be focused. That was very, very important. And I learned that the comfort of your, or the facilities you have are not a true reflection of the environment. So the environment was very nice. So by that time there were two visiting PhD students from Spain. And I mean, the spirit was very good, really, really good. And that's what made working in the corridor a fine experience, to be honest.
Yeah, you're not the first one to tell that, nor the second. What did you do in the second year?
Yes, in the second year, I think that's also a very interesting year. So in the first half, I got stuck in a new problem. It was very, very frustrating. And that's why I find it interesting, because there are not only positive things, the research can also be very frustrating and blocking, and a very important skill is to decide how to overcome that. So that problem, it didn't have so much interest, I think, from the application point of view. It has very nasty properties. So I was trying to find a nice research question that could fit that problem, but we found that after 6 months, it was not a good topic to invest. And I, in fact, it was the period of my PhD that probably I worked the most because I felt like I was not advancing. And I think that's also a very common feeling. You read, you try, things fail, you get blocked, you cannot do a proof.
But you learn a lot. That's the important thing that yeah, one should also take into consideration. I've been through that too. So it was a period that I could learn quite a bit, because you kind of force yourself to take the best of the research that you were doing. And sometimes it doesn't lead to promising results, but the ride might be very useful later in our careers, right? To acquire knowledge and also to face discouraging results and to overcome and to deal with that. So it's part of the life, right? Of the PhD life, or of any researcher in mm-hmm. general, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. So it was important to understand also what is to get blocked and frustrated. It's not that I didn't got before that feeling, but I didn't got for such a long period. So then the other half of that year, so 2013, we decided to work on kidney exchange programs from a game theoretical point of view. So these are problems where you have patients in need of a kidney transplant. Many times these people have someone that is willing to donate a transplant, but they are incompatible. So you kind of use these donors as a market power to exchange for a compatible donor. And this was already pretty studied in economics and was already being implemented in some countries. So we were going a step ahead and thinking, if we do these programs between different institutions, so let's say countries, there is going to be a game theoretical aspect involved. That is, I want to participate in these markets if it helps my own citizens, my patients. So what is the mechanism to match patients and donors that can handle this strategical behavior or preferences? So we work on that. It's definitely my favorite project from the PhD, and it was for a very, very long time, because it had a lot of graph theory, a lot about learning what is a matching and alternating path. Like there were things that I really liked, especially because the proofs are a bit more visual when you have graphs. It's not so analytical with a lot of notation. So I really liked it. And I find that it is my most interesting, or the contribution I'm the most proud during the PhD. Which was one that was quite hard to pass the reviewers' acceptance. Uh-huh. Like, we had to fight a lot. It was really mixing a lot of extremes from game theory to optimization to game theory. So it was a bit multidisciplinary in that sense. And interestingly, and I think that's also important to say, was a period where I was maybe working 6 hours per day, which I think is quite reasonable, and it was very productive. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because I was also focusing, due to the other experience of being blocked, doing to distract myself, do exercise, be with friends, and that balance was very good to when I was focusing, I'll get the good ideas. In fact, I think all the good ideas for that paper were during public transportation trips. I don't know if that happens to you, but for me, it's not in the shower, it's during public transportation trips. I always get an idea.
Yeah, for me, it's after midnight. Oh. Yeah, usually.
That was 2013, sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. And what about the third year?
Yeah, so the third year I went to Leuven-Lanov in Belgium to work with Mathieu Van Vif and Claudio Teglia, and we worked in a lot sizing problem. So it was a combination of a very, very classical game in game theory, that is Cournot competition, with lot sizing that's super well studied in OR. So we were considering a problem where you don't only try to minimize costs, as in lot sizing, but you also try to maximize revenues coming from this Cournot competition. So we integrate this together, and we try to understand what is the best that the players can do. And understand, of course, if the problem is easy to solve, when it is easy. That was the topic I worked during the third year. Most of the third year.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you did a lot in your PhD. You got the very prestigious Euro doctoral dissertation award. That was, of course, a game changer, not only because you published important papers, but also you were able to connect with distinguished researchers from our community. And that also gave you an edge, I would say, in the coming years. And let's talk about that. You finished your PhD in 2016. And then what was the plan?
Yeah, that is a very good question. So definitely I had a very good experience, so I wanted to do research, but I also was aware of the competitive and the hard time I would have if I wanted to stay in Portugal in particular. I would look to the Department of Math and try to think how many new professors they got. And that will make me think whether I should stay in academia, and so do a postdocs for years and years, and then maybe only very late to get a position or never get a position. So I was trying to understand what was a good idea to go to a company, to go to industry, or try my luck in research. And so when I submitted my thesis, I started to look to positions in companies also to get to know what I can do. And I got some interviews, some were positive, so there was a possibility of having a future in a company after the PhD. Specifically in one, but I asked them, okay, give me this extra time to give you an answer. And during that time that I was thinking, I came 2 weeks to Montreal to work with Andre in some pending papers. And yeah, things were very nice. I started a new collaboration. We concluded some ideas, and I was definitely convinced that research would really make me happy. And when I came back, I had a meeting with Anna Viana. She was one of my co-authors during the PhD, the person that had the network contact for me to go to Bologna, for example. So she was always an unofficial mentor during my PhD, and it continues to be a mentor until now. And so she told me, I can give you a postdoc position right after your PhD, and I'll be very happy to work with you. And yeah, I decided, okay, let's try that path. And she definitely saved me from not maybe following a path that I would not like.
Uh-huh. And what did you study during that postdoc period with Anna Viana?
So I had worked with her in a kidney exchange in the context of game theory, but we also had some work on robust kidney exchange programs, which in the end is just bi-level programming. So our tri-level programming in that paper too. So we had that work in robust kidney exchange programs that we were trying to wrap up. And we also worked in a problem in power systems where you want to install these devices that allow you to observe the state of the system. And according to where you position them, you can know what is the state of the system in positions that are not neighbor in the vicinity of them. So it's just a kind of a facility location problem, but where you cover is given by some particular rules. It's not given by customers' preferences like you have in facility location. Let's put it in that way. And yeah, we work in that topic also with a postdoc there, Ksenia Klimentova, which also became a collaborator for other projects. And it was very nice. The three of us, sometimes I would call them the dream team, because the environment was amazing. The research was just advancing naturally. Maybe because also when you are a postdoc, you don't worry anymore about doing a PhD thesis. You also got confident that you can do things. It was was very, very nice period, that almost 1 year of postdoc in Portugal.
Very nice to hear that. You mentioned three-level optimization. Bi-level is already really complicated, and three-level, it's, wow.
It's a nightmare.
Anyway, you then moved to Canada for another postdoc, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, So while I was in Portugal, that there came up this opportunity to come to Montreal. So they had created this institute that's called IVADO, where one of the missions roughly was to capture talent in academia and avoid brain drain to industry. So they had very attractive postdoc positions. And of course, my goal to come here will be to work with someone that I already know that we collaborate well, so with Andrea. And so I moved in March 2017 to Montreal for a postdoc, for my second one.
Mm-hmm. And how hard was for you to find a permanent faculty position?
Well, I can state how it was, and then people can judge how hard it was. So I think that's maybe common in women, that you just apply to positions that fit exactly your profile. So, or, and also people encourage you to do. That's also very important. I think it's a very important strategy. We are all very different, and our way to decide to take an action is potentiated by different situations. So I think with me, some people encouraged me, and also I would only apply to things where I think, oh yeah, yeah, I satisfy all of this, I can apply. So I applied to three positions. One was in supply chain, so I didn't got an interview. It kind of makes sense since I'm not really a supply chain person, and I'm much more in the theoretical side in OR, if you ask most of the people. And then I applied to other two positions, one at UDM and another in Europe. I got an interview on both of them. The one at UDM, so at Université de Montréal, was very well suited to me. While the other one, I knew they had people doing game theory, but they were not searching for someone doing game theory. So I had more hopes for the one at Université de Montréal. It was a very competitive position, especially because I was in Montréal, so I kind of knew who was being invited for the interview. So there were many people coming to have the one day interview that you have. And yeah, I got the position I think they told me in April 2018, and then I started in August. Of course, it was hard because you need to prepare, you need to have a good application. But I think it's also a combination of what these positions are looking for sometimes. When you get a no, it's not necessarily you are bad, it's just, it's not what we are searching for. So I think I was in the right place in the right moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you need luck ultimately in the end, right? So, but you have to be prepared when that happens, mm-hmm. right? So Margarida, what are your research contributions that you are most proud of?
As I mentioned before, the one on kidney exchange using game theory, I was very, very proud. I think it was because there were some patterns. This is something I always search for. I was seeing some patterns in the solution, and I wanted to show they always hold, so you can explore that from the algorithm point of view. And then I was getting blocked and not being able to advance. And then at some point you read more, you get some new ideas, and you can do it. So I think because of the challenge, I really liked it. And I also, when I see now people having their PhD thesis, topics that are very related and built on data, of course, I feel even more proud. It seems like I'm influencing and opening a direction that people also validate that it is important. So that work is certainly one that I really like. More recently, I started to work on two-sided matchings. It's kind of related because in kidney exchanges, you also do matchings. So in these two-sided matchings, they can model situations like college admission. So you have students applying to universities, and so students have preferences among the education programs that are offered, and universities may also have preferences that can be based, for example, in a national exam. So you want to find a matching that is successful. That means people don't feel like, oh, this is not a good solution. I can just call the director of this program and they are going to accept me. So I started to work on that, and in very, very, very simple variations of that problem that's studied in economics. It's a classical problem, very, very well studied there. And we started to look at very small variations that make the problem NP hard. And then you need to use mixed integer programming. That's a possible tool to tackle it. And it has been very, very enriching especially from the mixed integer programming point of view, because we can get some results, go to some results in the literature and generalize them to our contexts. And then there is this direct impact because it's applied to, for example, college admission, and we can make that process nicer for example, students.
Very nice. And what research questions you think are worth to be investigated when it comes to the combination of game theory, bi-level optimization, and mixed integer programming, not necessarily involving the three at the same time.
Yes, bi-level programming is just a dynamic of the game where you have sequential decision making, but you can also have players taking decisions simultaneously, or you can even have more sequences of decision making. But what I think these kind of problems have in common is what is the concept of solution. So if these problems are very hard, does it make sense that I assume that a player can choose an optimal strategy, the strategy that I am anticipating? So what I find that is important, that is, and it's not only me, it's also people from economics would say it, is to understand this equilibrium behavior, how to model, in fact, what is a solution of a game. While in an optimization problem is quite obvious, an optimal solution, what should be for a game theory problem? And that's very important to indeed be able to anticipate what players do in real life companies, how the competition evolves. That's one very important direction. The other one, which is also related, is because many of the game theory problems I look at, they come from socioeconomical contexts. And so we want to develop algorithms that can help to tackle these games, know what the players are going to do or set the rules for these games. And if we simplify and we don't consider strategical behavior, I don't think we are doing a responsible algorithm development. So I think although we don't study formal ethics, for example, in OR, I think we should control the algorithms we have. We should have more control on how they work. And so in the sense that we need to be sure that the solution that is outputted is not benefiting some people in particular. So let's say you do scheduling and you assign a schedule, two nurses. Maybe just because you labeled one of the nurses as nurse one, that variable is always going to be, branched first, and this nurse always going to get a certain type of schedules, while there can be other optimal solutions or near optimal solutions. So what I mean by that is we should be more responsible or analyze more, have a more critical view of the algorithms and approaches we have to see, are we benefiting someone? I know that in optimization, I would say that we care about giving an optimal solution, but maybe we can be critical about it. And the way to be critical about it is to account for behavior, preferences like we have in game theory, and look into what is that our algorithm outputting.
That's fascinating. I was thinking here of, work that will go like that, like introducing ethics in branching decisions.
I think that's... it's very hard to know how branching impacts, in fact, a decision, right? There is so many things happening in these branch and bound methods that we will not be able to control.
Yeah.
But we can apply them and then analyze them. Uh-huh. Because I think it's going to be much harder to change how they work.
Sure.
Give a responsible solution.
Yeah, but connecting these two completely different ways of seeing things. One is purely mathematical. The other one is thinking about fairness, behavior, and ethics. And thinking of that, and when designing an algorithm, when you think of branch and bound, branch and cut algorithms, they're already there. And then when you have to now add different ingredients to make decisions we have never considered before, it's really something out of the box and mind-boggling, I would say.
I think that, and for us, that is at least a mathematical challenge. So how we are going to maybe output more than one solution so the decision maker can decide. And for example, in these kidney exchanges, I have done work before that was showing, there are multiple optimal solutions. And these different optimal solutions, they help different sets of patients. So should we just let a solver decide which one it is?
Yeah.
That's the question.
Yes,
and it's still a mathematical question.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's fascinating, as I said. So Margarita, if somebody with a decent background in combinatorial optimization wants to learn about game theory and acquire sufficient knowledge to solve problems that combine both fields, what would you recommend?
Definitely try to take a class in game theory in an institution if it exists. Otherwise, well, if you have very good skills and knowledge of optimization, I don't think it's hard to get into the game theoretical topic, because in the end it's just optimization with many people, but very different from multi-objective optimization. But there start to be some recent work where that is, I think, more written for our audience, that try to show how to use mixed integer programming techniques in this context. Maybe it feels a bit self-promoting, but we have a tutorial that came out, that it is on archive since June, on the works that reviews the works that exist and the approaches that exist using mixed integer programming to tackle what we call integer programming games. So
that's very good.
I think that can be a good start, at least a place to get references. And another one, to if people want to understand better this equilibrium behavior and what means being strategical, a book that I really like a lot is one by Alvin Roth and Marilda Sotomayor, that is about two-sided matchings, where they explain very well, and with a real-world case, why if we don't consider strategical behavior, we can have very, very bad outcomes to society because of the way some markets have the rules. It's very, very nicely written. It essentially looks at problems where we want to match medical doctors with the training programs, and it explains how they were completely failing to do that in a successful way, how it changed when medical students started to get married, and so they wanted to go to programs that were in the same region, and so you had to change the rules. So it's also nice to get an understanding on how preferences and behavior play an important role in game theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's they are very nice recommendations. And as I said, that tutorial of yours, it's very, very good. And it can point a lot of directions and references, as you said. So it's very useful indeed. And what are the challenges of publishing papers connecting game theory with combinatorial optimization? You already mentioned that when you're talking about your master's work, but I would like you to comment more about that.
So I think, like in all multidisciplinary, and here is multidisciplinary maybe within computer science, because still these topics are part of computer science, there is going to be a barrier, because especially if it is a new kind of area, it's going to need reviewers that understand different fields, and so they might have a difficulty understanding, oh, why do we care about equilibria? Why don't we just solve a multi-objective problem? So, for example, one thing that people sometimes feel is very unnatural are these Nash equilibria, because in some games you can have Nash equilibria that are really bad for the players, and if they cooperate it, they could be very, very well. But because you cannot trust, you are assuming that's why you consider a game, otherwise it's not a game, you consider self-behavior, you can have very bad solutions in terms of outputs for the players, but it is a solution. So this kind of thing can make someone that never looked to game theory don't understand the purpose or are missing the point, or the reverse. You have someone from economics that understands very well why equilibria is important and so on, but it's like, why do we need mixed integer programming? Can't we solve this with a greedy method? Why do we care about it? So I remember at some point having someone not believing me that you cannot solve the knapsack problem. Like, oh, why can't you just use the prices and the weight, see what is the most valuable item per unit? So solving the continuous knapsack, why that doesn't work?
That's surreal. So
and someone that was very good in game theory. So sometimes, because we are going further in these two topics, getting the right reviewers might be a challenge. I feel that with time is improving.
Mm-hmm. And as an associate editor of three important journals related to war and game theory, how are you acting to help journals to take better decisions regarding interdisciplinary papers, especially those related to game theory and combinatorial optimization?
So as an associate editor, what I try to do is, of course, is articles that are in my domain, they might end up in my hands to handle. So what I try to do is to find good reviewers that can at least understand one of the topics, and then that I can mediate, that I have the capacity to mediate, read myself, and try to take a decision when they are in extremes, which is sometimes not so rare to happen. And to also, one very important thing is to seek encouraging reviews. And you can still reject the paper, but be encouraging. And I think that's very important, especially when admitting that a direction is nice, maybe the way you handle it is not the most interesting one. So, especially in game theory, things are very hard. We cannot have very high expectations that, for example, we can compute all Nash equilibria or solve this very fast. It's not going to happen in one paper. We need to go step by step. So, also, how demanding we are with the articles is something that needs to be mediated. Sometimes we are very exigent as reviewers.
Yes. Yeah. So it's very hard to find a balance, but we should always look for that. So we can keep the field alive, encourage young researchers, and at the same time keeping a good level of research and that's been published out there, right? So changing the direction of our conversation, was there any professional situation in which you felt a sort of a disadvantage because of your gender?
So certainly when I was playing soccer, I was usually people would assume I was very, very bad. And some coaches would be biased towards that. But going over that part, talking more about what's more recent, the academia, I don't. It's not clear that I faced a situation that really impacted my life. I had very good allies, and that's also very important that you have a network of mentors and people that protect you, that can give you another point of view, that can be encouraging, because recognition is also important, that you make the others feel confident to also say good things. But definitely there have been situations where we go to organize a seminar, and people expect that I decide the food. And I don't want to decide the food, I want to decide the speakers. That's more interesting. Of course, especially during my PhD, I went to many conferences that were just men. And I think that kind of reduces the diversity of experiences and connections and networking that exist, because we all network in a different way, and it's expected that maybe women and men, that is going to be a big difference. So I felt that a lot, especially during the PhD, that conferences, I'll kind of feel alone. Now, maybe because I'm in Montreal and everyone at some point came to Montreal, that's different. And of course, you expand your network. But I felt like, especially because it was mainly men, that also changed a bit my experiences during conferences. And now when I look to my graduate classes, especially, there is almost no woman. So that is really a reflection that, okay, I think during the bachelor, I see more of them, less underrepresented groups, but then there is some kind of filter or issue that they don't come to masters or PhDs. There are a few of them. So there is certainly a challenge there. And then when we go to academic positions, because there were already less women in masters and PhDs, we expect to have less women in academic positions. And that all to say that now that we are more aware of these underrepresented groups, when there are committees to all different kind of tasks we need in academia, you want to have the voice of diversity. So you want to have women. And then which we are already a small fraction, we are called to be in all committees. So there is also this challenge of, yes, we want to be more inclusive, have more different voices in committees, but then always the same people asked to do the same committees. So I also want to do research. It's a challenge topic, and there are of course still gender issues that we are trying to solve, but even the solutions are not maybe the best ones.
Yeah, I understand your points. They are all relevant for sure. But as Gret van der Berge also mentioned when I interviewed her, is that it's interesting to have female faculty members involved in committees and, you know, this type of activities, but that at the same time, it might take a toll on them because they have extra work and it becomes really hard to do so many things at the same time in a high level. So I completely understand your concern, and we should keep thinking of ways of finding solutions that are inclusive, yet it's not that super time consuming for a fraction of the community that is should be playing an important role in that regard. Margarida, you were still very young, yet full of very impressive accomplishments. I'm a big fan, by the way. So you are also a very enjoyable person to talk with and seemingly pleasant to work with. That makes you a role model for sure. At least that's my opinion. Would you like to conclude our conversation by saying a few encouraging words or by giving academic advice to many young people out there?
Yes, of course. It's going to be an advice, an unsolicited advice, but my message would be to focus on the research questions you find that are interesting. Put all your effort there. Of course, be sure you are equipped with the skills that are probably necessary to answer that, but guide your efforts and actions and priorities to what is relevant for science, and avoid, of course, something that maybe we all do, that is to compare yourself or to try to be the best. I don't think that should be the target, to think about the best, but to do the best for science. And that would be my message for more junior researchers.
All right. Margarida, it was lovely to talk to you. We connected recently in Santiago during the IFRS conference. It was super nice to meet you in person. And I would like to thank you for your time. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Yes. If you want to visit Brazil and, you know, our place here, João Pessoa, always consider contacting me and we can arrange something for sure.
Thank you. Yeah, for sure. I will go.
Okay then. So take care and let's see if we can meet soon in the next years. Tchau, Margarida.
Bye.
Muito obrigado. Tchau.